This is the Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour. It's my pleasure to be back on your radio. I'd love to hear from you today. Send me a message, 0487 993 222. So we do have the breaking news that the US and Iran have agreed to a framework extending their ceasefire for 60 days. A formal signing ceremony of the end of hostilities is expected in the next week or so. We're stuck into what that might mean, particularly for shipping for our exporters. And a look at how we got here on the Country Hour today. But we're going to get there in a moment because I want to start in a different foreign country today, and that is Indonesia, because the federal government says it will spend up to $1 million to help fight the outbreak of lumpy skin disease in Bali. Now, the disease has been spreading through Indonesian cattle since 2022, and while Australia remains free of the disease, our government has been providing doses of vaccines in that country. So far, 1.4 million doses, in fact. Now, this new funding that's been announced today will provide an extra 250,000 to 300,000 vaccines. Now, the government says the funding will help protect livestock industries in Indonesia and hopefully prevent the disease from getting to Australia. Thomas Robinson asked the Federal Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, Julie Collins, what difference this funding will make on the ground in Bali.
What this means, of course, is that there'll be more vaccines available on the ground and help Indonesia help contain this lumpy skin disease. We do know that since 2022, it has spread across Indonesia, and we are working with the Indonesian government. We've now provided support of 1.4 million doses of lumpy skin disease vaccine to the government. We've also had our CSIRO, Centre for Disease Preparedness, working with the Indonesian government laboratories and surveillance, and we've also been doing some training to try and help in terms of the animal diseases in our region with them. So this is very significant. An additional $1 million we expect will purchase somewhere between 250,000 and 300,000 additional vaccines.
The messaging from government and industry when lumpy skin disease made it to Bali was, I guess, everyone should be alert, not alarmed. Has that situation changed? Has there been a big spike in cases to sort of inform this response now?
No, this is us continuing our work with the Indonesian government and us continuing to work with industry and with our partners in the region. Australia has a national lumpy skin disease preparedness plan, and we continue to work with our close neighbours on making sure that we do everything we can do to help them, but also help protect Australia's border, which is obviously really important to us as well.
What's the timeline for this rollout of the $1 million and the extra vaccines? Has it already started?
Well, we want to get it out there as quickly as we possibly can. And as I said, it does come on top of the fact that we've already provided over 1 million vaccines and working with the Indonesian government in terms of doing everything we can to lift in terms of their laboratories and surveillance and their training as well on the ground. So this is about, as I said, supporting our neighbour, but also about protecting our borders. I mean, we've now invested, since we've come to office, around $2 billion in additional funding for biosecurity since we've been in office. And that includes things like supporting our neighbours with these vaccines.
I think, sort of based on my conversations with people in the industry, any biosecurity funding is obviously welcome and it'll make a difference. But I guess the question they always have is, can you commit to sort of an ongoing program of funding, or is this going to be a sort of one-off spend?
Well, we continue to work with our partners in the region about what additional work might need to be done. And certainly we know that these vaccines will be welcomed by the Indonesian government and by industry, because they are part of our ongoing work with Indonesia to make sure that we do everything we can. We continue to work with industry more broadly on biosecurity, and as I said, those investments have been very significant from our government.
Does the spread of lumpy skin disease to Bali specifically increase risk to Australia any more than it would if it spread to another island in the Indonesian archipelago?
Yeah, well, we've obviously seen it in Indonesia. I think it's across 21 provinces and a range of islands there. So we're actively monitoring the situation, as you would expect us to. And as I said, since lumpy skin disease has been in Indonesia, we've, you know, checked our biosecurity settings, and we're very confident that our biosecurity settings and our border requirements are as appropriate as they need to be and will help us manage that risk. You know, we also have said that travellers returning from Bali don't present an increase risks provided they follow the standard biosecurity measures at the border. You know, we encourage people always to, you know, make sure they let us know where they've been and what they've been up to, and to fill in that traveller declaration card appropriately.
This sort of ongoing response and assistance to Indonesia, how do you measure the success of the program? Is eradication the goal? Is that possible? How would you sort of give it a big green tick?
Well, that will be obviously up to the Indonesian government, but any reduction or containment, I'm sure, would be welcomed. I mean, you know, Australia has been free from lumpy skin disease. We've never had an incursion here. We want to make sure that that remains the case, which is why we're also working with our near neighbours and helping them, you know, contain their outbreak, and we'll continue to do that.
Minister, you visited Indonesia in August last year, I understand, and saw the live export trade in action. What did you sort of think of how that's going and how important the industry is to both nations?
Yeah, it was terrific to visit Indonesia last year and to meet with various counterparts, ministers, but also to hear from industry and see industry directly about how important this is, you know, to Indonesia. And certainly when you look at President Prabowo's plans in terms of, you know, he's feeding the school kids in Indonesia, I'm sure it's a very significant part of what they need to be able to do, and they want to increase their ability in terms of their ability to feed their nation. So I think that they appreciate the partnership with Australia hugely.
On that partnership with Australia, have Indonesian representatives or authorities asked for assistance with other biosecurity matters? I'm particularly thinking with FMD, and my understanding maybe they're talking about other species that Australia could help with.
Well, we're always in discussions with our neighbours and providing our biosecurity expertise across our region to do what we can do to help our near neighbours, but also obviously to keep Australia's borders secure. I mean, it's part of the role of keeping Australia disease-free from some of these diseases is working with our neighbours in the region, and we continue to do that. We do it on a whole range of different diseases and a whole range of different countries.
There's been an ongoing sort of conversation between industry and government about cost recovery with live export. And my understanding is funding was given to the Live Animal Export Division of DAF fairly recently to establish a new framework for live animal exports. In your view, Minister, how is that relationship and conversation progressing around cost recovery?
Yeah, well, we've certainly been in a discussion with a whole range of industries, the various different sectors of the agriculture industry for more than 12 months now in terms of the cost recovery. What we've done since the outbreak of the war in the Middle East, after discussions with industries, we have deferred the implementation of that. It was supposed to start from 1 July this year, and we've deferred it for 12 months. So it'll now come into effect from 1 July 2027 and will be phased in. And it'll be phased in through to 2029. So what we have done is we've worked with industry to make sure that they're aware of the cost recovery process. I have had and been involved in briefings directly with all the different industry groups, and certainly, you know, we have provided additional funding and supplementation over that period of time of well over $138 million, and we continue to work with industry in relation to the cost recovery process.
I'm watching the TV here in the studio. You'd be aware of the news. The US and Iran have reached a peace deal, or a deal to suspend hostilities, I should call it. That's sort of just happening this morning, and I appreciate the government is probably still piecing together exactly what's happened, but what can you tell us at this stage?
Well, obviously, the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister have certainly welcomed the news about the peace deal in terms of the Middle East. I understand it's due to be ratified in a week's time, and certainly as a government we have always called for de-escalation, so we obviously welcome that de-escalation, and we also want to see that Strait of Hormuz, that's so important to the world's economy, reopen as soon as possible, and that's been our position really from day one. In the meantime, of course, we've been getting on, and we've been doing everything we can do as a government to help shield Australians and particularly our primary producers, our farmers, from the worst impacts of this war in the Middle East, and we'll continue to do that. We're not sure yet, I guess, on obviously how long it'll take to get the strait open. We're not sure about how long a tail this is going to have, but we'll continue to work with industry and the sector, and we continue to engage with them regularly on it.
Federal Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, Julie Collins, speaking to Thomas Robinson. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour, and it's coming up to a quarter past 12. Now, we will take a look at what that potential end of hostilities in the Middle East might mean for shipping in just a moment. But as you heard, that is an agreed framework to extend the ceasefire between the US and Iran that could lead to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, if you're cautious about getting excited about the potential end of hostilities, that's probably pretty understandable, but the Memorandum of Understanding does mark the war's biggest diplomatic breakthrough. And in a moment, we'll look at what that might mean for shipping. But first, Patrick Clawson, who's the Director of Research at Washington Institute for Near East Policy, explains more about the agreement and how it came about to Sarah Morris.
Basically, it extends the ceasefire, allows the Strait of Hormuz to open, and in return, the United States will lift its blocking of ships going into Iran. But everything else gets down the road. Everything else gets postponed for further negotiations.
And if this deal between the U.S. and Iran gets over the line, what do we know about how it might work?
Well, past experience has been that short memorandum of understandings like this reach between two parties that don't trust each other and which have a long history of being very suspicious about the other one, typically don't last. And so it will be difficult for this deal to actually produce very much because the two sides seem to have quite different understandings about what they're going to get out of it.
And what countries can be acknowledged for playing key roles in getting this framework together and getting this over the line?
Well, certainly Pakistan and Qatar were two absolutely essential negotiators because the Iranians refused to talk directly to the United States. And so somebody had to carry messages back and forth between the two, which is a really awkward and difficult way to carry out diplomatic negotiations. The Qataris and the Pakistanis seem to have done quite a good job, but frankly, all of this could have happened a lot faster and easier if the Iranians would talk to the United States directly.
Now, if we imagine Washington eases sanctions on Iran, would Iran's internal business environment change at all?
Well, almost certainly not. Our experience of the 2015 agreement, when there was much expectation in Iran and around the world that it would be possible to have lots of business deals with the Iranians, businessmen were quickly disappointed by discovering just how bad corruption and bureaucracy is in Iran. And so, therefore, very little happened. Furthermore, the deal in 2015, like this one, was really a framework and left in place a lot of sanctions in addition to the nuclear sanctions. So the nuclear sanctions get lifted, but there's terrorism sanctions, there's human rights sanctions, and those stayed in place. And as a result, businesses said, thanks, but no thanks.
Patrick Clawson, Director for Research at Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking to Sarah Morris. So with that agreement in place, the key players are saying the Middle East peace deal that has been agreed to could possibly see shipping resume through the Strait of Hormuz. That will be significant for the world economy. But Shipping Australia says the maritime sector has already made significant changes to supply lines as a result of the conflict. David Claughton has this report.
Seafarers will be cheering if a peace plan proves durable. Many ships have been attacked just in the last week. People have lost their lives. Jim Wilson from Shipping Australia says three vessels were attacked by the US as it continued its blockade on Iran, including two oil tankers, the Marivex and the Jalvia.
So the other attack was the Setebello on the 9th of June. The Paolo flag Setebello is an oil tanker. It was attacked in the Gulf of Oman, again a missile was fired into the ship's engine room after the crew did not comply with directions from US forces. Three seafarers are missing, presumed dead, following the attack. And then on the 11th of June, the US CENTCOM, so CENTCOM is the United States Central Command. It's got the area of responsibility for the Persian Gulf and much of the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea. On the 11th of June, the Guinea Bissau flag Jaldir, which is an asphalt bitumen carrier, was attacked as it attempted to transport oil from Iran through the Gulf of Oman. So that's the body of water just to the right-hand side of the Strait of Hormuz. Again, U.S. aircraft fired missiles into the ship's engine room after the crew repeatedly failed to comply with directions. As of 12th of June, U.S. CENTCOM forces have disabled 9 ships, redirected 135, and have allowed 42 vessels supporting humanitarian aid to pass the U.S. blockade. Iranian forces have been harassing shipping as well. So this is not one side or the other, both sides have been doing it.
Despite the ongoing conflict and loss of life, fuel, fertilizer and chemicals have been finding a way out of the Middle East through a couple of terrestrial routes.
There's a pipeline that runs across the Arabian Peninsula under the sands of Saudi Arabia, and it goes to a port on the Red Sea, which is the other side away from the conflict, and that port is called Yanbu. It's a bit less in the line of fire, but that's not to say it's completely out of the line of fire, because it has been attacked. And that's got a capacity of 5 to 7 million barrels per day of exports. So this is really important. When we see a lot of the analysis, and especially from the oil analysts, a lot of people say, oh, you know, the Strait of Hormuz, 20% of world oil, you know, production goes through the Strait of Hormuz. And that is true. However, a good 5 to 7 million barrels, which is about 7-10%, goes through Yanbu, or can go through Yanbu. So there's been a lot of oil movements out of Yanbu and through the Red Sea. Now, that, I think, has been a bit of a relief valve and has possibly stopped everything going very disastrously wrong for the world economy.
It's not the only new route for fuel to get out of the region.
The Emiratis are halfway through building a pipeline, I think, to Fujairah, and that is outside the Persian Gulf, and that's all the Strait of Hormuz. So if and when that is built, I suspect we will see the significance of the Strait of Hormuz declining over time. Then on top of that, we have all the renewable situation, and the people of the world is decarbonizing, is moving away from fossil fuels in every way, and I know a lot of organizations and people might not like to hear that, but it is true. We've been talking to a lot of the shipping guys, and they've been reporting, for example, they're carrying a lot more electric cars now than they've done previously.
So if this current ceasefire holds and shipping resumes through the Gulf, the supply of critical inputs for agriculture and mining to Australia will certainly ease. But Jim Wilson thinks the issue has largely been resolved anyway.
The stock holding of the various kind of fuels that Australia has actually gone up since before the conflict. So the amount of, you know, diesel and gasoline and so on that are being held in stockpiles in Australia is now more than it was before the conflict began. And there are a few reasons for that. I think a couple of the primary ones is the Prime Minister relaxed some of the environmental standards on what fuels can be refined in Australia. So I think that's been a factor as well. And also there's been, you know, some very highly publicised deals. But from the shipping perspective, I was speaking to a Shipping Australia member about this the other day. Ships are coming. It's business as usual. And, you know, I totally understand what you said, because we all thought the same thing too. But, you know, the members were like, oh, no, things are going to be terrible. And everyone was a bit worried. And then, you know, we say, oh, well, we've got visibility for 4 weeks. We've got visibility for 6 weeks. But then there was visibility for 8 weeks. And now you find out the members who are involved in the oil and gas trade, and they say, yeah, we're not really seeing any change, to be honest. And we don't really foresee any change from what we can see at the moment.
Jim Wilson from Shipping Australia speaking with David Claughton. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 23 past 12. What do you think of the developments today? Is it as urgent as it might have been a couple of weeks ago, or have you found a business as usual balance that's really not as not hanging on whether or not the strait reopens? I'd love to hear from you today. 0487 993 222, or you can send me an email, countryhour@abc.net.au. Now, later in the program, you're going to hear from some graziers in the far north of the state that are frustrated by the conversations they're having with their local government over their rates. But up next, before you hear from the Weather Bureau, take a look at the dry that's continuing in parts of southern Queensland.
Who will win the AI race? Has gambling become our national sport?
Questions. They've never been more important. So the one thing we'll never question is our duty to keep asking. ABC News. Keep asking.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
And I'd love to hear from you. So send me a message on 0487 993 222, or you can send an email to countryhour@abc.net.au. Now, it has been a season of extremes across the state's southwest. Some properties have been drenched, while others just down the road have barely seen a drop. That patchy rain is making life tricky for graziers hoping for drought declarations. And it's got everyone watching the skies for what comes next. I'll have the Weather Bureau on your radio very soon for the week ahead. But in the meantime, Louise Martin is the Southwest Director on Ag Forces Board and also runs a property near Tambo. Bella Munro asks her what it's really like on the ground right now.
The seasonal conditions in the southwest go from feast to famine. Even within particular areas, it's been a very unusual season. There's people who've had amazing rain and other people not far away who've had very little rain. So it's a really mixed bag this year in the southwest.
And how has that been causing challenges for farmers and graziers across the region?
Well, drought and dry conditions always bring challenges. One of the challenges would be if you're trying to look for drought declaration, would be it's quite tough if it's not universally dry, and it's more difficult to get independent drought declarations. If some people's poor seasonal conditions are helped by having buoyant livestock prices and wool prices, etc. at the moment. So that's something, I guess, for those people who unfortunately have missed out.
And what are some of the areas that are approaching drought declaration across the region that you're aware of?
That I'm aware of is mostly in more in the southern border area going east from about Bolin and to the east, that they have just seriously missed out, and south and southeast of Roma, been very light seasonal conditions. The further west you go, generally speaking, the better it is. But that's not to say that there haven't been those people who have missed out either. So it's a very, very weird season this year.
Lots of areas in the southwest have seen a little bit of rain in the last week or so. How has that improved conditions in some areas, and is it anywhere near enough to keep drought at bay?
Traditionally, we summer rainfall here. For example, we at my place, we had 20 millimetres a couple of days ago, and I'm unsure if that's going to be beneficial or not, because it's most likely going to damage our summer grasses, especially if it gets cold, which it can do in Western Queensland. And whether 20 mils on the black soil is enough to get any response is doubtful. There has been some good totals I've seen around Cunnamulla and Yulo and places, you know, 40 mils. And that is really useful rain and should grow some herbage, especially for, you know, handy for sheep producers. The result of the rain is also variable. If you have only got a little bit, it can be damaging. But if you've had a good fall, well, hopefully that will provide some benefit. Overall, there's a level of buoyancy. Our markets are strong for our livestock. That's always puts a bit of a spring in people's steps. I do genuinely feel for those people who have missed out on a rainfall season this year. It's never easy, and it's always tough. So, you know, we're thinking of all of those people who are battling on and with their livestock in dry times. We had a yellow-tailed black cockatoo run across here today, which is a very unusual sighting because they're out of their natural habitat here. And we've never known a yellow-tailed black cockatoo to come past here and not have good rain in the near future afterwards. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed indeed. Louise Martin, the Southwest Director of AgForce, speaking to Bella Munro. And if you're near Roma, AgForce is hosting 3 Innovation in Ag Field Days this week. Tomorrow that will be at the Bell Golf Club at Avenel West of Roma on Wednesday and at Killarney Park on Thursday. Staying with the situation with the rainfall or lack thereof for now, we'll head now to Dalveen near the Queensland-New South Wales border, where Tanya Burcham runs goats, cattle and chooks. Now, conditions on her place got so tough, she made the call to reach out for help, something a lot of people can find pretty hard to do. But Rural Aid stepped in with feed for her animals, and not long after that, the rain started to fall.
It's complete despair, really. That's what it is. You just don't know what else to do. to see your livestock actually getting a bit skinny is really disheartening. It's really sad. Distressing to a point that you don't know what to do, and then you go to try and sell your stock, and you've got to find that right time while they're still healthy before they start getting too skinny.
And I would imagine before everyone else is selling, and it affects the price as well.
Yeah, of course it does. Yeah, the more that the market's flooded, the less you get. So it's a bit of a fine line, and we've missed out on last year's lambs to sell. So at the moment we're having to just feed them and see how we go next month and see if we can get something for them. Yeah.
Well, speaking of recent times, it has been a little bit of a change around in the weather pattern. What's the last month been like for you?
So the last month we have got rain. It's actually uplifted our hearts. Hasn't made the grass grow, but it's green. So seeing green grass is uplifting. It gives you hope that there's going to be moisture in the soil, that we do get some warm days, that we might get the grass to grow. They're forecasting a warmer winter, so maybe that will happen.
Is that just going to make you feel a bit more positive going forward as well, Tanya? I mean, it was looking pretty dire, particularly, you're having to reach out for help with feed and that sort of thing, and now maybe it feels like it's turned a little bit?
Yeah, I hope it has. It's never a good feeling to ask for help. It was one of those things that, no, people are worse off than me. I don't deserve it, you know. But then when rural aid turn around and say, yes, you do deserve it, and yes, you can get it, and we will get it for you, it's really amazing feeling. So, yes, it has. Seeing what's happening now is uplifting, yes. We will always say, yeah, we're fine, but really we're not. Mentally-wise, you see it all around. Like, I know I will often have a tear in my eye when I'm just looking at the desperation of things.
Yep.
And that's why I'm working. But then that takes me off the land as well, which is where I would love to be and improve. But we, for an example, I was at our local fire shed one night for training, and you know we were at the in the dry, and everyone was sort of hunched over a little. You know, yeah, I'm okay. It'd be good if we could get rain. And then we started getting rain. Like that night we were standing there and it bucketed down. And do you know, we were all standing upright. We were all laughing. We were all joking. It just was an immediate mood changer. You know, that rain just brought in a bit of hope.
Yeah, like someone had popped a bottle of champagne or something.
Yeah, it truly was. It was. I don't think anybody could have done anything different to make us feel that way.
Dalveen farmer Tanya Burcham speaking to Dan McRae. And if you're struggling, remember you can always call Lifeline 13 11 14, or you can reach out to Rural Aid like Tanya did. Now, to get in touch with them, the number's 1300 327 624. That's 1300 327 624. Or you can find them online, ruralaid.org.au. And if you're one of those that's having a cracker of a season and wondering what you can do to help those less fortunate, there's also information there on how you can donate to Rural Aid as well. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 27 minutes to one. Up next, we'll find out what's on the agenda for the week ahead when it comes to the weather. That's still to come.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
And you can send me a message 0487 993 222. I'd love to hear how your season's going, if you're having one of those unseasonable seasons, or if things are pretty steady as she goes. 0487 993 222. A little later in the program, we're going to celebrate one family's acknowledgement for their contribution to the industry. And we'll learn about some new tech that's coming for graziers when it comes to contraceptives for their cattle. That's still to come on the Country Hour. But right now it's time to get the latest update from the Weather Bureau. Baden Gilbert, it's the senior forecaster on duty this afternoon. Hello, Baden.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Now, how did we fare over the weekend? Was there any sense of this new moisture that might be on the way this week?
So over the weekend, most of the falls were confined to eastern Queensland, with just some very light falls about the central interior showing up. And most of that was, again, about the north tropical coast, where we did see an excess of 25 millimetres about the area around Innisfail, some places getting up above 50 millimetres through there. Yeah, along the rest of the east coast, it was mostly pretty light, apart from some more decent falls in the vicinity of Proserpine and Bowen.
But is that set to change this week?
So, as we go into this week, for the first half of the week, we're going to see a continuation of that pattern with a high to the south leading to trade winds, which means showers on the east coast, a pretty normal pattern for Queensland at this time of year. Those showers will be most likely again about far north Queensland, but still a chance for the rest of the east coast that will gradually contract northwards from about Wednesday or so. Separate to that, we're going to watch a band of showers and possible rain enter the southwest of the state on Thursday. Initially about the Channel Country, and then on Friday, spreading from an area from roughly Mount Isa through towards Charleville, or maybe even down to St. George. So that will be something we're watching for, potential to maybe see some falls in excess of 10 millimetres, isolated up to 20 possible on that day. From there, it'll keep moving eastwards, but weaken as it does so. So lesser falls as it makes its way in towards the Darling Downs and other parts of the central interior, and then onto the east coast, but still... some more rain coming at the end of the week for areas that don't normally see it at this time of year.
What about temperatures as well? Because some of that concern for graziers at this time of year can be that the rain comes and it gets cold, which can be bad for the pasture.
Yes, it can indeed. But I suppose the good news is that we're in a pretty warm run of temperatures at the moment. Apart from the far north of Cape York Peninsula, pretty much everywhere sitting above average for June at the moment, and that's set to continue for the coming days. We could see some cooler maximum temperatures after this rain band, but those minimum temperatures aren't looking like they'll be super cold in the wake of it, so any risk of frost looks to be super low for the coming week.
That's probably good news to many. And away from that particular, I mean, I was going to say away from that cloud band, but you said Mount Isa to Charleville, so there's a lot away from that. But what else are we expecting for the coastal regions as that cloud band moves through?
Yeah, it's a bit of a tricky one as we get into the weekend. The system that's driving it really starts to weaken off from Saturday. So while we're still forecasting showers for the coming weekend as that system makes its way through places like Emerald and Chinchilla down into the Granite Belt, it looks like it'll be a bit lighter, more around that broader risk, or sorry, broader chance of single-digit numbers rather than double-digit numbers for those communities. And then, yeah, the totals really do drop off as it makes its way to the east coast. So for much of the east coast, it's just going to be showers maybe easing back south of around Yeppoon or Rockhampton from Wednesday, and then picking up again on the weekend, but no huge totals coming in the coming week there.
And on the water, what's the coastal forecast looking for over the next couple of days?
So with those enhanced, with the showers on the east coast at the moment, we do have some enhanced trade winds. So we have strong wind warnings current from the Mackay coast all the way up to the tip of Cape York Peninsula on the east coast for today, and they'll continue into tomorrow with those fresh and strong southeasterly winds, and then maybe even see some on Wednesday as well. Those winds are a bit more easterly in the Gulf and then a bit lighter further south, and will lighten off further as we get into the middle of the week.
Thank you very much for your time on the Country Hour today, Baden.
That's all good. Have a good afternoon.
Baden Gilbert, the senior forecaster on duty at the Weather Bureau for you today. We'll keep an eye on the weather for you right here at ABC Radio. Make sure you follow your local bureau on Facebook so that you can get the latest warnings if they're relevant to your part of the state. Of course, you can always check out the Bureau's app and website. You are listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 22 to 1. I've got a text message through on 0487 993 222 talking about that rags to riches situation with the weather. The message says, I was talking to a bloke east of Killarney the other day who'd had 300 mil since April. I asked him, which April? Because we're just 10 kilometres away and haven't had 300 mil since 3 Aprils ago. Sounds unusual, but isn't for that mountain country around here. That's the kind of local insight I do love to hear. Thanks for sending that through. What a tale of two different states just 10 kilometres away from each other. Thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate it. You can share your experience of the country too, 0487 993 222, or send me an email, countryhour@abc.net.au.
A tray of cocktails floated at us through the twilight. Who was this Gatsby fella?
A jazz-soaked reimagining of the great Gatsby.
That's the best thing a girl can be in this world. A beautiful little fool.
Search for Gatsby in Harlem on ABC Listen.
This is the Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Before 1 o'clock, we'll celebrate the achievement of a Queensland family that took an empty block of dirt and turned it into a national winner. We'll hear that story before 1 o'clock, and I'll also bring you some interesting developments in the world of cattle contraceptives that's still to come. But for now, we're going to head to the north because a group of North Queensland cattle producers are frustrated that their local council won't explain how their rates are determined. They say they are paying more than their peers without reason, and that's not fair, as Sophie Johnson reports.
For 3 years, the Cassowary Coast Graziers Association has been asking their local council one question: how are their rates determined? But grazier Jason Berzicott says there's been no answer. They're not necessarily asking for lower rates, but a clearer explanation from the Cassowary Coast Regional Council.
The rates are grossly inequitable, incredibly inequitable. You know, we pay the highest rates in the dollar of all the East Coast peers by a long margin, and that's been the case for 10 years now. We're the only Cassowary Coast rating category to be in that space. Every other rating category benchmarks reasonably well with their peers. It's just us out by themselves in that space. There's a lot of road burden data, there's a lot of ability to generate revenue data that all points to rates being grossly inequitable. So we're just trying to get Cassowary Coast to explain why they think our rates are fair and reasonable.
Based on the association's research, Mr. Berzicott says on average, rates are costing graziers about 30% of their gross profit margins. Graziers like Anthony Kalija.
In short, what the council's rates charge is doing to me at the moment is for every 3 cows I have in the paddock, they take 1 every year. And that's just to pay council rates. It's crippling. I don't think much explanation is required what losing 30% of your income to one service sector does.
The Cassowary Coast local government area stretches from north of Innisfail to south of Cardwell. Like all councils, their rates are calculated by multiplying the rate in the dollar by the valuation of land, a value determined by the state government. This year, farmland valuations in the region rose by 60%. While the council has no control over the valuations, they do control the rate in the dollar, which Mr. Berzicott says is higher than their neighbours.
It's about 1.8 cents in the dollar, and the next highest being the Burdekin at about 1.4 cents in the dollar.
He says other shires also provide more services to support the livestock industry.
Some get stockyards, some get support with exclusion fencing, stock routes, sale yards. There's some pretty extensive support provided by some of those shires to the graziers. Cassowary Coast, even though we are the highest rate in the dollar by a long margin, we get no specific service whatsoever to graziers.
Jason Berzicott from the Cassowary Coast Graziers Association. In its revenue policy, the council says it takes into consideration the land's ability to generate revenue and the sector's burden on the road network when calculating the rate in the dollar for farming. In the past, all farms were rated under a single primary production category, but this financial year, the council split it into subcategories for livestock, sugarcane, horticulture, forestry and aquaculture. Despite differences in the revenue and road use, they're all currently paying the same rate in the dollar. The council's chief executive officer, Andrew Graffin, says the system is equitable.
You can't compare grazing rates by looking at the rate in the dollar alone. And council saw a significant reduction in the rate in the dollar in our 25-26 rate in the dollar than what was presented in 24-25 in our revenue statement. And that was because we saw a significant increase in land valuation, so that rate in the dollar dropped.
Mr. Graffin says the budget tries to balance rising costs with the needs of all ratepayers, including primary producers.
Those sort of things include everything from, you know, our local roads and bridges. We're up there in the top 10 councils in Queensland for the the size of the decks on our roads and bridges across the region, drainage and our rural and our urban areas. Obviously, we have a significant road network with over 1,200 kilometres of road. A large portion of that is unsealed. Like I said, general rates contribute to things like parks and public space, also community facilities, libraries and public amenities, some waste-related services, disaster preparedness and recovery, as well as planning, compliance, administration costs. So the general rate is there to cover all of those factors.
Responding to the graziers' concerns, the council was not adhering to the requirements in its revenue policy. Mr. Graffin says council aims for fairness.
Look, council's revenue policy is a guideline that's intended to promote the best practice. So we set out some principles there, and they're around equity for like properties, user pay where can, meaningful contributions, providing predictability for the ratepayers and fairness.
But Mr. Berzicott says the graziers aren't satisfied.
All we were asking of Cassowary Coast Council is to tell us why they reckon our rates are equitable. That's all we're asking, which is, by the way, in line with the expectations of the State Government Minister's Charter. It's in line with the expectations of the Queensland Audit Office. It's in line with the things they espouse in their own documents. We just want to know why. And we're 3 years on in this exercise. Cassowary Coast Council only has to tell us why the rates are fair and equitable, and this whole matter is closed.
The council is expected to deliver its next budget before the end of June.
Sophie Johnson with that report, and you can read more online. Head to abc.net.au/rural. While you're there, sign up for the weekly rural newsletter. You'll get great stories from across Queensland and the country. You can stay up to date with the conversation everywhere when it comes to our rural industries and people. You are listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's just gone 12:45. We're going to stick with the cattle industry for now because Australia's largest cattle company, AACo, has invested in a pharmaceutical startup called Sorensis, which is developing a non-surgical contraceptive implant for female cattle. The Chief Executive Officer and founder of Sorensis is Dr. Kim Agnew, and he says over the years there have been various companies looking at this type of technology, but with the help of AACo, he's confident Sorensis can take it commercial.
Well, the concept is not new, right? The concept is simply an implant that would go under the skin of the ear. It would be designed to be applied just like a hormonal growth implant. And the goal is a duration of 12 months contraception. So, but we understand that there's a varying need, Matt, right? Some producers might want 6, some might want 9, but the fundamental aim would be 12, but there'd be variations on that.
If I was holding one of these implants right now, how big is this thing?
Yep. Currently you'd be looking at something that's about 35 millimetres long and about 3 millimetres in diameter.
Yeah, right. So, this sort of tech that you're talking about is replacing the old method of spaying animals.
Well, look, I think the key is to provide the option.
Yep.
Certainly, Matt, the key is to provide the option. There may still be some reasons why producers may want to spay, but I think from a management of flexibility perspective, it means that you don't need to schedule the vet. You can manage your stock as and when you wish to and do the contraception according to when the stock are coming in. So maybe it will save a muster. I'm not convinced that maybe it will, but potentially it could save some mustering time.
How significant is it for your company to now have AACo, the nation's biggest cattle company, invest in Sorensis?
Look, a little bit hard to give a particular adjective, but of course it's tremendous. It has been part of the strategy that we wanted a customer on the cap table, and to get AACo, all I can say is that I can think of nothing better to develop a product designed for the customer sitting around as a shareholder, right? Because we will get a much and more depth understanding of supply chains, market need, how they see the economics of it, the value that they see. because I'm sure there'd be question there around pricing, right? And
you can't price
something without really understanding the true value, and there's still lots of areas that we need to explore around what such technology could offer the industry. And then, so to me, that is the key part. Obviously, the money for a founder and a shareholder is, and a startup is fantastic. But I think the real value is going to be in the discussions that have started already with management, the R&D team, but particularly the frontline cattle producing people.
For me, just calling around some cattle producers today to pick their brains about this and what sort of questions they'd like me to ask you. Of them said, what's it going to cost? Which you've sort of already alluded to, but, would you have a price range in your head already, though?
Well, look, I guess what I've done, obviously you do, and what I've done is I've gone back to the costs of spaying, right, and how that would be assessed, and then there's different ways of doing it, but I think the correct way is you look at the procedural cost, then you look at the potential mortality cost. There's that part of the spaying costs, and depending on heifers or older cows, because the mortality is quite different, that sits between $20 to $30. I still hear spaying is $5 and $8. So there'll probably be some discussion now, I'm sure, about the figures that I'm quoting, but the important thing is to make sure the potential mortality is put in. But I have had pushback from producers to say, well, you know, that can be part of farming, and they're more interested in knowing the exact procedural cost. So what you and I both know, Matt, is that this will be a real source of discussion. And what I want to do, though, is to make sure it's got to be commercializably available for producers. It's got to add value to the value of the price that we want to charge. But polymers are expensive. Right. I won't back away from that. This technology has not been done before. Right. Bear in mind that at the moment, despite 30 years of attempt, nothing has been commercialized. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, cost is certainly one. The other area is that no one's been able to build a tech that's lasted long enough from a single shot. Right, so we have got the strong technical challenge. It's a huge issue to solve. It won't be cheap, but it has to be for us to make any money and for the producers to value. It's got to be in a ballpark that's going to be feasible for the value that we offer.
The Chief Executive and Founder of Sorensis, Dr. Kim Agnew, speaking to Matt Brann. And if you'd like to hear a longer interview, you can find it online. Search for ABC Rural and look for the Sorensis AACo deal on the Northern Territory Country Hour, and you'll be able to hear more about that particular technology. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 8:01. Up next, we're going to celebrate the contribution a family has made to agriculture in a very public way.
This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
A Bowen mango farm that started as a bare block of dirt more than three decades ago has been recognised as Australia's Family Business of the Year. Ben and Ashley Martin from Marto's Mangoes took out the national award at Hawk Connections, which recognises their commitment to innovation and industry leadership. What started out as a small orchard has grown to a 30,000 tree operation by embracing new ideas long before they became mainstream. Ben says the focus on the farm remains the same as it was in 1990, growing quality mangoes and building on the legacy started by his parents.
They were both working full-time and wanted to get into agriculture. The R2E2 was just released back then, so they thought they'll grow mangoes in high density, which back then was unheard of. Yeah, we've slowly grown the business from there.
Ben, what's your history with farming?
I've always been on the farm as much as I can. So, you know, growing up as a kid with, you know, granddad and dad out there every minute. I finished school and went and did an apprenticeship as an electrician, and then actually went and worked in the underground coal mines, and that's where I got the deposit for my first farm.
How did it feel knowing that you were nominated?
Yeah, look, it was a huge shock. You know, you don't expect to be nominated for this sort of stuff, let alone, you know, win the award. And I suppose you sit back and look at it now from what the family's created. You know, mum and dad are still out here every single day. We're still a true family business. Yeah, it's a huge honour. If you look at the other people that were nominated in the category, you know, there's some amazing, you know, generational family businesses there. Yeah, to be put in the same category as them, it's pretty good. Makes you feel good. You know, it's the whole family that's achieved this. It's not just me sitting here talking. We really have had that experience, and it's good. And, you know, it's not just the family, but it's the friends and people in the industry that have helped us over the years as well. You know, there's been some amazing people that have come and helped over the years, and, you know, we wouldn't be where we are today without that support and help from friends and people in the industry as well.
Why do you think you were nominated?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, look, I don't know. We're heavily involved in the industry, so we do, you know, I'm chairman of Australian Mangoes and on board of Queensland Fruit and Vegetable Growers and a number of other boards, and I suppose that's something that's come down from Dad, you know, that he's always instilled to me that you need to give back to the industry that you're involved in. So, you know, it's always easy to sit on the sideline and throw rocks and stones and, you know, say this isn't done right and that should be done better, and, you know, you should be doing this and you should be doing that, but you've actually got to get involved in your industry if you want to make change. So that's, we've been doing that ever since its inception, really.
How important is it to give back to the industry beyond your own farm gate?
Yeah, look, it's really important. You know, you've got to give back to industry, and not just industry, but local community as well. You know, so we sponsor, there's that many different things in the local community we sponsor. You know, there's a lot we do in the community, and it's really important to, I feel, you know, give back to the community that's given us and our family so much over the years. So you just be fortunate that you're in the position that you can, and you do it. So it's good.
What have been some of the biggest changes that you've seen in the mango industry, particularly in your time?
Look, probably the biggest changes is the automation that's coming in now. So we've just purchased a fully autonomous vehicle that goes down and mows all of and slashes all of our trees. The technology that we implemented in the shed with the grading systems, I reckon that's been the biggest change that I've seen in my time. You know, I look at the last 10 years and just how fast automation and AI has come within the agricultural industry, and, you know, I think the next 5 years is going to be phenomenal. We try and do everything ourselves during the off season, so you know, we don't employ anyone. It's just the mum and dad, my wife and I on the farm, giving you time back to actually go and work on other aspects of your business, you know, rather than just running up and down the rows slashing, which, don't get me wrong, I actually enjoy, you know, sitting on the tractor slashing, but when you've got 1,000 other things to do, it's good that you can send a machine out there and it just does it, works 7 days a week. It just, same as us, just goes.
Ben, what's your advice to other farmers out there that might be sitting on the edge about taking the leap with this sort of innovation on their farms?
It's expensive, it's risky, but it's worth it. There's always going to be challenges with automation and AI, but you need to be prepared to work with the technology. If you get to a roadblock and you throw your hands up in the air and go, oh, look, that's it, you know, it's a waste of time, you'll never make it work on your business. But, you know, I think with the technology that we've seen over the years that we've implemented, we've learned a hell of a lot from the failures at certain points and then, you know, what we have to do to overcome that. And the technology that we've got running in the business there at the moment is, phenomenal. It's really worth it.
Innovation was also a big part of the award that you won. Can you tell me about how you've used that in your business over the years?
Innovation's been a key part of the business. So, you know, mum and dad started in 1990 planting high-density mangoes, which, you know, that was unheard of. You know, we're 6 metres between the rows and 3 metres between the trees, and we'd growers scoffing at us saying that they're going to buy a bulldozer because they're going to make a lot of money, you know, in a couple of years' time, because that's not how you grow mangoes and all the rest of it. You always have those people that come and try and knock you for doing something different, which I'm sure a lot of people out there experience. But, look, if you've got a vision, you just got to follow it, which was what mum and dad did back then, and showing one of the big things happening in the industry now, 30 years later, is high density planning. It's something, if you've got a belief, you've got to follow it through.
Ben, where does the focus lie for the future for Mardo's Mangoes?
There's a lot of areas there. Quality is number one. We don't do what we do without quality. We get it wrong sometimes, like everyone, but you know, you've got to focus on quality, I believe. Yield is something that we're working on. How can we increase yield in our trees? The best way to influence productivity is and profitability is increasing yield on trees, so...
Ben Martin from Mardo's Mangoes in Bowen speaking to Amy Mitchell. And that's it for the Queensland Country Hour today. Remember, you can listen back to the program on ABC Listen or wherever you get your preferred podcasts. Now, we are expecting the Prime Minister at some point today to stand up and talk about the deal between US and Iran. Keep listening to ABC Radio for the details on that, and also tune in to your Rural Report at 6:15 in the morning. I'm Callie Buchanan. It's 1 o'clock.